Okay, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this panel on forgotten authors. My name is Martin Edwards. I'm a participating moderator in this panel. And we have a very distinguished group of people here to talk to you today about some of their favourite authors of the past, people who are possibly neglected nowadays, but for a whole variety of reasons, we think they don't deserve to be. And over the next hour or so, we'll try to convince you why that is the case. The theme, therefore, is forgotten authors of the past. We're very anxious ourselves, naturally, not to be totally forgotten authors of the present. So before I start asking questions about the authors of the past, I'll ask each member of the panel briefly to introduce themselves and their books. But first, just to mention by name, starting from the left, Declan Hughes, Sarah Rain, Mary Andrew Clark, and Barry Forshaw. Barry, as he will explain in a moment, is the author of, I think, the most monumental volume on crime fiction ever written.
Editor, I
should say. Editor and contributor as well, I think. And I think that he will have a great deal to say about some of the less well-known authors of the past. But first I'd ask Declan to say a little bit about his writing.
I write a private investigator series featuring Ed Loy. The books are set in Dublin. I've written four, the latest of which was published here last month. It was called All the Dead Voices.
Sarah?
Yeah, I write psychological thrillers, which are usually described with the adjective dark. It's usually a question of the past influencing the present and a dash of historical material in there as well. The latest one is called Ghost Song and is out hardback January, paperback July.
Mary?
Right, I write historical crime set in late 18th century, southeast England, London area. My first novel, The Crimson Cavalier, was published by Creme de la Crime in 2007, and the second, Love Not Poison, is out in September, linked by a short story which is in Criminal Tendencies, which I'm sure you all know is a charity.
Barry?
Well, I'm the odd man out. I'm the only non-novelist here. And I wrote a book called A Rough Guide to Crime Fiction, but I also edited a book called British Crime Writing, for which several contributors are in this room and on this stage.
Thanks very much. I should say, can you hear us perfectly well? All microphones working? Fine, thank you. I should say that we will try to allow ample time for questions later on in the session. And I've also been asked to make it clear to you, not only will the members of the panel be signing books after the panel is over, but before we get to that point, during the questions, think about this. There is a prize, a bag of books, for the person who asks the question judged to be best. So there you go. Quite an incentive. We have quite a number of authors to talk about. I'm not quite sure how many we'll get through, but if I may start with you, Barry, and Francis Clifford is one of the authors you wanted to talk about.
Yes, I've got three. One of them really is forgotten. I don't know how many people in this room have heard of Francis Clifford or remember him as one. You'll remember the films. There's a film called The Naked Runner with Frank Sinatra about a man who has his son kidnapped. There was a rather poor film called Guns of Darkness based on one of his books called Act of Mercy. He's a wonderful novelist. And why he has fallen off the radar, I don't know. Just because of the vagaries of publishing and so forth. So I picked him as a forgotten writer. But my other two choices were Eric Ambler, who is being republished almost as we speak. And I don't think he is a forgotten writer. But I did write a review for The Times, I think, of his last book. And the publisher said to me, when they were trying to sell the book to bookshops, booksellers didn't know who Eric Ambler was.
Oh, dear.
Yes, I'm glad I get a response. And it had to be explained to the youngish booksellers that this is a man without whom there would be no John le Carré,
yes,
and there would be no modern spy novel as we know it. And my third choice would be Peter O'Donnell, who's the creator of Modesty Blaze, who I know have a few fans in this audience.
That's right, and I think there's also one other you might like to sneak in who's a writer really unknown to me called Alan Williams.
Alan Williams. Alan Williams is my party piece. Anybody in this room know Alan Williams? No? He's the son of Emlyn Williams, the playwright. He wrote wonderful novels that are kind of like always about an Englishman at bay in some sultry climate. They're very Graham Greene-like, rather Ambler-like in many ways, too. Completely forgotten. Pick up an Alan Williams book, if you can, called Long Run South, Barbouze, Snake Water, and you won't regret it.
Fine, thanks. Thanks, Barry. Now, could you tell us a little bit more about why you think Francis Clifford was such a good writer?
The main thing about Francis Clifford is that it's the characterization which is never out of boxes. Every character in his novels, the book Act of Mercy, which is about a man who has to rescue a dictator in a totalitarian country, every single character in the book is brilliantly defined, including the reluctant pregnant wife of the hero who has to be dragged across this country with him. The orchestration of the tension is brilliantly done, and it's never in any synthetic way. It comes out of the situations. He's just basically a good writer, and the quality of the prose is elegant. It's well written, better written than many a better remembered writer.
Is the pace still there to a modern reader, do you think?
That's a good question. That's a good question. Probably like a Hitchcock movie. Now, if Psycho were remade again, which had been badly remade once, could they get away with just 3 moments of suspense? Because audiences are less patient.
Sure.
Are readers less patient?
Sure. Well,
I'd say this audience, surely this audience would be patient enough to stick with the book.
Sure, thank you. Mary.
Right, I've chosen Ethelina White, who I see a lot of blank faces there, and I had quite a job getting copies of her books. But again, going back to Barry's point about films, I'm sure you've all heard of The Lady Vanishes.
Oh, yes.
Hitchcock, which he did an excellent job with Margaret Lockwood, and very suspenseful film. There was some embellishment in the film, which is to be expected, but I did find it a really good book. It was very atmospheric. I think she's very good at playing with people's minds. The central character, Iris, who's obviously lost her friend, Miss Roy, well, more of an acquaintance than a friend, of course, but spends the whole time searching for her. And we get inside her mind, and she starts to wonder herself, well, am I crazy? And it's all done from her perspective, and I think it works so well. Now, there isn't a corpse appearing in the first chapter, as is expected now, but I think the way she builds up the characters, and I say builds up the suspense and the tension, just from this poor woman who feels like she's going psycho because she can't find this person, and everyone's saying, oh, no, this, you know, we don't know who you're talking about. Another one I read was Wax, which I had a job to get, which I think it's got this wonderful cover, the Collins Circle, 1930-odd. I particularly like the ad for the watch on the back, which I think you wouldn't get now. But again, it's this girl who spends a night in a wax museum in this sort of pokey old town that she's moved into, and it sounds very sort of B-movie 1930s, 40s kind of stuff, which I suppose it is, but it's very atmospheric. And again, we get into the central character's mind. She's a journalist, which in itself was a rare thing in that day and age. Everyone's saying to her, oh, what are you doing that for? Why don't you just get married and you're taking a job from a man and all this kind of thing? But it was very tense, and the way she wound up the tension was marvellous. Another author I've chosen is Georgette Heyer, who I know is known for her Regency romances, but she wrote 12 rattling good detective yarns, set in the upper class, mostly set around families, but good characters, lots of humour, which I think we've come to expect from her, and again, good plots, and she put it together very well. Just by a solicitor husband, I believe.
Yes.
They're being reissued right now.
That's right. I think both in the US and the UK, there were some quite nicely produced UK paperbacks a couple of years ago. Just sticking with Ethelina White, one of the things you should never try to do, tip, never try to buy a first edition in a dust jacket of Ethelina White, because they're phenomenally rare and very, very expensive. They were published in the Collins Crime Club in the 1930s, and they're much sought after by collectors. Even some of the very obscure titles that weren't turned into films. There's one called The Spiral Staircase that's been filmed 2 or 3 times, I think, by Ethelina White. So she actually wrote the books that formed the basis for three very famous films, which is quite something, and yet very few people have heard of her today, which is quite striking, I think. Would you say these are really Woman in Jeopardy novels? Is that a fair description?
I think that's a fair description.
Yeah. But not lacking, or are they, in feminist, early proto-feminist leanings?
Yes, I'd say there's some early feminist leanings. Certainly, so Wax has got the central character as a female journalist, and you know they look at her and it's like, oh, what are you doing here? And they do gradually come to respect and accept her. Now, the lady vanishes. The central character Iris seems to be pampered, poor little rich girl kind of thing, an orphan on her own, but never had to do a thing for herself in her life. And yet, the thing that struck me is she's very conscious of that. She keeps thinking over the fact that she's been very fortunate, and that somebody, when she first sees Miss Freud, it's like, oh, this boring little spinster woman in a dull tweed suit, and she thinks, oh, well, I'm very lucky, I'm better than her, I've got money, I've got friends to help me, and suddenly she's on her own fighting the whole of the train.
It is a very gripping situation. Of course, Hitchcock made the most of it. The original book is called it was originally called The Wheel Spins, but Hitchcock spelt out the issue in the story rather more clearly as The Lady Vanishes. But it's almost like an impossible crime story, isn't it? The, you know, what can have happened to this woman, the mysterious Miss Freud? And there's that great scene in the movie with the words written on the letters written on the window, which is one of the great sort of moments.
Same plot as So Long at the Fair, isn't it? Where somebody vanishes and nobody will acknowledge they ever existed.
That's right. Or Phantom Lady, Cornel Woolrich, which is one of the great dark American thrillers of the 40s, and also a brilliant film. Coming on to American and Canadian writers, let's stick with the Canadian writer first. Declan, you have one of my favourites on your list.
Yeah, I guess she is Canadian to begin with, and it is a mystery to me how she's been forgotten. I doubt if she's been forgotten by anyone in this room, but Margaret Miller, who was the at one time the better known spouse of Kenneth Miller, also known as Ross MacDonald, who is actually my other choice, prompted by the fact that The Guardian saw fit a couple of months ago to select 100 crime novels everybody must have read, and omitted Ross MacDonald completely. I won't name some of the candidates who bumped him off the list, but they certainly didn't deserve to be there in his place. Margaret Miller is an interesting writer. She's kind of, you can define her almost by what she's not. She writes very deft psychological studies, but she's not as misanthropic as Highsmith. She's very funny. She's got a great kind of, I would describe as a very feminine wit. She's very attuned to how women undermine themselves and each other while pretending not to. And she observes that very wittily, and also then the point at which there's a certain incipient hysteria in female characters and how that can operate in a suspenseful way. Really, really gripping and kind of disturbing, but also very funny. And it's a curious balance, each of her books. She had a great stretch in the late 50s, early 60s, when she was Beast in View on the Edgar. And then there was The Soft Talkers, The Listening Walls, A Stranger in My Grave, and How Like an Angel. They would be the big five. She's completely out of print now. She's also, sentence by sentence, I think, one of the crime writers who can write. So she's a very strong stylist.
Yeah, very cute style, and this combination of very strong settings, great characterization, but also great plots.
Absolutely,
those five books. Yeah. The plot, How Like an Angel, the revelation.
That's right. I was going to say, she is a brilliant plotter without being smacking at all of the golden age. She does extraordinary reversals, and she really cracked that problem Chandler suggested you couldn't solve, which was that you couldn't have realistic characters and a brilliant plot, because in order to lead the audience along the garden path, you had to actually cut corners with your characters. Or if you let your characters breathe and grow, you couldn't make those reversals work. And Margaret Miller squares that circle brilliantly.
That's right. There's a book called Stranger in My Grave that Declan mentioned, which has at the start of each chapter a line, and right at the end of the book, all the lines are put together and reveal what actually happened. Quite a brilliant concept. I was so impressed, I borrowed it for a book of mine. What greater tribute can the writer pay to another?
She's also a Canadian, like her husband, a Canadian who became a Californian. Yes. And so there are Mexico plays a lot. She lived in Santa Barbara, which became Santa Teresa in Ross Macdonald's books. So there's an interesting Spanish American thing going on, threaded through all the books as well, and a kind of environmental thing. She wrote a book about birds. Social consciousness that they're very rich books. They're not overstuffed. I wouldn't want to give that impression. Very, it's a mystery to me completely why she's out of print. Mm,
yeah, I agree. Thanks, Declan. Sarah.
Yeah, I've got two authors to discuss. The first one is Frances Isles, who is a pseudonym of Anthony Berkeley, which I think Martin's going to touch on. So just briefly kicking off with him. Obviously, the biographical notes for him are the same as Anthony Berkeley, so I shall leave it to the maestro to do that part. Although one of the interesting things I did find out about him was that in 1939, he stopped writing fiction altogether. And I haven't been able to find out why. Again, I'll hand over to you on that one. But, you know, there might be a plot in there somewhere. He's tentatively credited with being one of the very earliest writers to tackle psychological crime, to turn the whodunit upside down by starting off revealing the murderer. In fact, in his book Before the Fact, it opens with this sentence: "Some women give birth to murderers, some go to bed with them, and some marry them." And Malice Aforethought starts, "It was not until several weeks after he had decided to murder his wife that Dr. Bickley took any steps in the matter." So the reader's on tenterhooks for most of the plot. Not to know who's going to be murdered or who the murderer is, but when it's going to happen, how it's going to happen, even is it going to happen. He did four books that I've been able to find out about. Malice Aforethought and Before the Fact, as I've said. And there are two others, The Rattenbury Case and As for the Woman. Now, the only copy I found of As for the Woman was priced at £99, and as we were talking earlier, you do a lot for Crime Fest, but, you know. In fact, we were talking earlier in the green room about how you get copies of these out-of-print books. And I think it's a shame that a lot of these lovely second-hand bookshops have vanished. But I have to say, the internet has got its own quirky charm. I've bought books from sellers who have names like Alice the Fat Dog, Salty Mavis, and Captain Jelly Twinkleman. But even they couldn't help with the Rattenbury Case, I'm afraid. Before the Fact was actually the base of a 1947 film, Suspicion, with Cary Grant and Joan Fontaine. And oddly, Malice Aforethought was dramatised on TV a year or so after I discovered it. And I think it's quite strange. I don't know if people would agree with me that you discover something, a book or a place or a hobby, and you think it's obscure, and then all of a sudden it's not. It's being televised, or somebody's discovered it, or it's becoming international. And it's a shame. It was a very good dramatisation, and it's a shame that it didn't really do much for Frances Isles. I thought it might sort of regenerate him, but it doesn't seem to have done. And the writing, there's an irony, a tongue-in-cheek look at the snobbery of the characters. And also there's the very distinctive class division that you get in books of that era, which can either be irritating or you can regard it as illustrating the outlooks of the time. But there is one line that I always enjoyed in Before the Fact, and it's, "On the whole, Lena enjoyed her honeymoon." The more you think about that, the more meaning.
I've got to make the best of these things.
I thought of that one, yes. That book actually is solely told from Lena's point of view, although it's not first-person narrative, which I think is quite unusual because you can get a lot of tension if you write from the point of view of the victim, you know, inside the victim's mind. But you can't make the victim too sympathetic because you're going to lose him or her. And you've also got to find a way of getting round what happens after the murder. You're going to cut off that whole point of view.
That's an interesting point because you mentioned the Hitchcock film Suspicion, which probably everybody in this room has seen. There's a reason for reading the book because Hitchcock was not allowed to film the book. He could not have Cary Grant as a murderer. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the famous ending that Hitchcock wanted,
couldn't be done.
Where he gives her the poison glass of milk and Cary Grant posts the letter that incriminates him, was not done. So read the book.
That's interesting. Yeah.
But they were going to. They were. It was a kind of last minute battle. I think he filmed the alternate ending.
No, I think the Breen office said this will not do.
Yeah, and but I think Cary Grant and Joan Fontaine thought they were going to.
He wanted to do it.
Yeah. And then it was a last minute decision to reverse it because it is it and actually funnily enough that does work because you're suckered in and then. Well.
But in fact, Martin said earlier in the green room, what we should say to people is why they should read these books. There's a reason to read the book.
Yeah.
Patricia Highsmith's Strangers on a Train, because Hitchcock keeps coming up. Because if you want the real ending that Patricia Highsmith wanted, it's not in Hitchcock's wonderful film.
It's such a shame though when films do this. They so often draw the teeth of something, or they change it. If a character is described as not pretty but interesting, they'll put some blonde bimbo in.
And, well, back then, it's to do with the image of stars, because Farley Granger could not commit a murder in Strangers on a Train. Cary Grant could not commit a murder. So the books have to be altered.
And writers console themselves by saying, well, the book will always be there, but the existence of this panel goes to show that it may not. You know?
So that is my first one, and hopefully we can get to the my other one, Christiana Brand, if time permits.
We certainly will. Just finishing off on Frances Isles for the moment, the third book that Sarah mentioned, As for the Woman, I have read it, and it's fascinating. It was rejected by his usual publisher, and was published by a small publisher as a love story, which was not a good description of it because it's not really a love story. It's about something very corrosive, a very corrosive relationship. It's actually based on the Rattenbury case, which Isles or Anthony Barclay was very interested in. And it's a fascinating book. It's full of this irony and cynicism that Sarah was talking about. And it's a failure, really, as a novel. But it's a fascinating failure. And you can imagine that he put so much effort into that particular book and cared about it. Is a complete flop, and as Sarah rightly said, he never wrote another novel after that.
Which
he gave up.
That just knocked his confidence so much.
Yeah, I think he became disillusioned. But he did become
so much.
But he did become a crime reviewer, and continued to review crime for another 20-odd years. So so you never know what may happen. Yes, he lived for another 25 years, lived until the 60s, and he was one of the first people to recognise P.D. James and Ruth Rendell as great new talents when their first books came out.
I found it interesting trying to... I was sort of familiar with some of the books we were discussing, but I wanted to have a little bit of a working knowledge of the others. And I found it interesting how many of these writers that we are placing in the 1930s, which is perhaps when they did a lot of their work, did in fact carry on and were still writing in the 70s and the 80s. And I think there's one who even had, I'd have to look at my notes, who even had something published right up to the 90s. You know, they span a great era, these
people.
But
that answers one of Martin's questions, which he asked us earlier. Why aren't these people read today? They lost their mojo in some cases.
Yeah.
Eric Ambler's a classic case. There are some wonderful late books. His best work are those early books, Journey into Fear, Mask of Demetrius, The Night Comers. All his early books are his best books.
Did they move with the times, I wonder? Did they allow their characters? You know, is that perhaps why they didn't keep writing and keep being successful? Because their characters... We talked a little bit about the racism, the classism that the characters of that era do portray. That was how people thought. They used words that were offensive, we wouldn't use today. Did they move on? Did they sort of let their characters take on board the modern way of being politically correct?
Ambler certainly did, or he tried to.
I think one of Martin's choices, Julian Simmons, certainly did.
Yes, he did.
Isles was different. As Anthony Barclay, he wrote some very clever detective novels, some quite brilliant ones, actually. There's one called Trial and Error, which is an absolute classic, about a guy, nice, inoffensive guy who never does any harm to anybody, and then he discovers he's got an incurable disease. So he decides to commit an altruistic murder to rid the world of somebody who's really awful that nobody likes. So he commits the murder, and then somebody innocent is charged with the crime, and the inoffensive little man, Mr. Todhunter, is unable to prove that he did it. That's the setup of that story. And there's a very good trial scene, and it's again full of Anthony Barclay's cynicism. But one or two of the early books do have, in particular, an anti-Semitic edge in the 1920s books. The very first book he wrote, quite shocking in a way to any modern reader, I think. And that may explain why a couple of his very early ones in the 20s haven't been reprinted for a very long time. Although the plots are very clever, but the writing leaves something to be desired. That's less true, I think, of the Francis Isles books.
Yes, I do wonder, actually, if we as writers today set a book in the 30s or the 40s, how do we cope with that one? You know, because that's how people spoke and talk and thought. Would we be
well? Andrew Taylor's
allowed?
Doing it, isn't he, with the Lidmouth books? Right. And he's,
you have to take it on board.
He's
I think so. Yeah.
If you look at a TV soap like EastEnders, where nobody swears, nobody uses four-letter words,
or watches television.
Yes.
well. The point Declan makes is an excellent one. Andrew Taylor's written a great book set in the 30s called Bleeding Heart Square, which is to some extent about the rise of fascism in Britain in the 1930s. And there's an amazing scene towards the end of that book where one of the fascist characters is ranting in a speech. And Andrew actually told me when I asked him that he took it, I think, nearly word for word from a speech that was actually made around that time. But the phrase that is repeated more than once, I think, was British jobs for British workers. Plus ça change. Interesting. So,
Martin, you did say something interesting, that all these things spread out like a kind of coruscating light. An altruistic murder, there's another great forgotten writer I know has supporters in this room, Geoffrey Household. And his most famous book, Rogue Mail, is about an altruistic murder of Adolf
Absolutely.
Hitler.
Yeah.
Another forgotten writer.
And another writer who wrote his best work early on, I think, it's fair to say, but carried on for many years. A couple of writers I'd like to mention, because they were writers who influenced me a lot in my early days as a crime fan, as a teenager, Michael Gilbert and Julian Simmond. Michael Gilbert was a solicitor who wrote between the 1940s and the end of the 90s. So he had a very long career, won the Diamond Dagger, very prolific, wrote all kinds of books, classic whodunits, thrillers, spy novels, short stories, and a very smooth stylist. And one of the things that appealed to me about Michael Gilbert, I read everything he wrote, really, in the 60s and 70s, was that I wanted to become a crime writer, but I also wanted to eat, and my parents wanted me to get a proper job by becoming a solicitor, which I eventually did. And they pointed out to me that Michael Gilbert was a solicitor and he managed to write crime novels, so he was held up to me as an example. Michael Gilbert, quite truthfully, wrote his books commuting from Gravesend into the centre of London. Unfortunately, I drive to work, so that is a luxury not available to me. And he once told me, because I actually had the privilege of meeting him in his later life, that he told a fellow writer this story, and she refused to believe him. She thought he was lying and thought it was impossible for him to write his books simply on the train. And he said to me, I didn't have the heart to tell her that I was too tired to write when he was coming home, so I only wrote on the morning train in. But Michael Gilbert is a great entertainer, and he wrote a classic mystery that this is often referred to called Small Bone Deceased, yeah. which is set in a solicitor's office in Lincoln Inn, where he was a lawyer himself. He was actually a very successful lawyer, and his clients included Raymond Chandler and the Sultan of Bahrain. So a mixed portfolio.
What was the Raymond Chandler case then?
Well, he wrote his will.
That actually, that just puts me in mind of Henry Cecil, who wrote a lot of legal, very good books. We're a little bit later than the era we're discussing, but he was a solicitor rather than a barrister.
He was a barrister actually, and he became a judge, in fact, Henry Cecil.
And there's a certain charm about just very simplistic writing, but I know we're not focusing on that era. So
but a very funny writer, Henry Gilbert. Cecil, who again has rather faded from view. Mm. And some of his books are comedies, but some of them are sort of mysteries. I think it's fair to say.
I think the Brothers-in-Law was filmed, wasn't it, with Ian Carmichael and Richard Attenborough.
And Terry Thomas.
Yes, he usually got in, didn't he, Terry Thomas, in those films.
So Michael Gilbert, Small Bone Deceased, is a classic. There was a late book which I thought was brilliant, again with a legal setting, called The Queen Against Carl Mullen, which did absolutely nothing. And he did tell me how disappointed he was that in his later life he laboured very hard over that book and it got absolutely nowhere. It was an unjust fate for a very, very fine novel indeed. There's also a book called The Night of the Twelfth, which is a bit darker than the normal Michael Gilbert style, and that's a very grim but very effective mystery. As I say, quite dark and quite untypical, but a very fine novel, and I strongly recommend it.
Isn't it interesting that court scenes seem to be such a good hook for readers?
Yeah, and Margaret Miller did one or two, didn't she?
That's right. Yeah.
Spiderwebs was one with.
Yeah, there's more than one. Yeah, yeah.
She had a legal character called Tom Aragon.
Yeah.
Who was was he California lawyer?
Mexican. Yeah, yeah.
So again, yeah, different type of writer.
I wonder if it's because a court scene, there's the inexorability of it, and yet there's the ceremony of it, you know, everybody in wigs and gowns and certain procedures that have to be followed and certain things that have to be said, and yet at the end of it somebody is going to be perhaps locked up for 10 years, or not so far back, was actually going to be hanged.
It's also kind of helpful with the structure of the book if you're struggling. You have a sequence,
yes.
You know.
I know it's laid out for you, isn't it?
That's right. I think the one thing they miss is the sheer tedium of waiting for hours and hours whilst the judge comes back from lunch, which can take a while sometimes. Julian Simmons is another author who was a contemporary of Michael Gilbert. They were both born in 1912. They both wrote for roughly a similar period. And Julian Simmons again began in the 40s with relatively conventional crime novels, but he ultimately became an acknowledged master of the psychological suspense novel, and he didn't particularly have a series character, but some of his books are very fine indeed. The Progress of a Crime won the Gold Dagger, but there are many, including some historical mysteries that he wrote. But again, Julian Simmons constantly entertained the reader, and his books weren't overlong. They weren't sort of 700-page. Airport type thrillers, but they're very, very gripping, and again I had a number of court scenes. There's a very good book called The Man Whose Dreams Came True, which I think has a couple of court scenes, and also a very good book called The Man Who Killed Himself, which I think is totally forgotten, but I think is one of my all-time favourite books.
Those two, along with The Man Who Lost His Wife, they were the Penguin had
There's
those
an
in it.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly.
And
right.
He's also very funny,
yeah.
Very, very sharp eye, very, very witty, and good on the kind of the suburbs, good on social trends in the 60s. Solomon Grundy, Solomon Grundy, yeah.
He also wrote one of the very best histories of the genre in Bloody Murder.
That's
absolutely.
Right, he's your precursor. I have three separate editions of Bloody Murder because he kept
Which
adding
is a fascinating
to it.
Read because you'll read him talking. he's always spot on about authors who look like they might be something.
Yeah.
He spotted the talents early on, even in the updated editions, because all those books are out of print, as I know to my cost. Mm. Immediately they're printed. It's a fascinating read.
That's right. And again, as a reference book, as well as Barry's books, it's worth having a look at Julian Simmons' Bloody Murder, because he's a very elegant writer. Of non-fiction as well as fiction, and his critical judgments are very astute, sometimes acerbic. He's not always entirely kind.
John Creasy tried to get him drummed out of the CWA.
That's right, yes.
Because he was writing reviews which criticised other crime writers, and Creasy thought that was not in the spirit of the wonderful Freemasonry we all like to share. But Bloody Murder's great because it does things that are good, are always good to remind ourselves of, which is that not all crime writers are very good writers, and some exceptionally good writers try crime and don't do very well at it, and pretty much all points in between, and Simmons is very sharp at highlighting those things and pointing them out.
One of the things that I'm noticing about the authors that we all picked, I think almost all of us has said the writing is good, it's deft, but we've all mentioned humour. It's almost as if you can be as black, as dark as you like, but you've got to have that sprinkling of...
I think, Sarah, you mentioned Christiana Brand.
Yes, which we may not have time for, but yes, certainly, there was wonderful... it's just the odd sprinkle, and it's as if that's important, that's necessary, because life is like that. It's not all black, it's not all doom and gloom. You do get the patches of humour. And I think we've perhaps all, and you as readers, and writers, a lot of you, would appreciate that. So I found that interesting. I was listening.
Yeah.
Yes, we've all got that, haven't we?
It is a bit of a common thread. Now, Mary, I've got to confess I've read very little Georgette Heyer, so I'm not sure whether there is much humour, but tell me a bit about her.
Well, yeah, she's mostly known for her Regency romances, and I gather she sold... An average circulation was 115,000 copies, and her detective fiction was less popular. She only sold about 16,000 copies of them, which I'd be quite happy with, but, you know, there you go. She wrote very good characters. She did write very humorous characters. There's a lot of bantering. One of the crime novels I read, there's this guy found on the village green in the stocks. He's just sitting there. He's got a dagger in his back, and his hands or his legs are good. In these stocks that people used to have in years gone by to throw cabbages at whatever they did to them. But his brother and his half brother and sister afterwards, they're kind of speculating about this, but they're bantering back and forth in this very dispassionate fashion, and the policeman's kind of looking despairingly at them, but it works somehow. I can't explain how, because it does seem very heartless, but they're just speculating as though it's an intellectual exercise. And yet the characters seem realistic. One book I read, it did have this cantankerous old lady who, I have to say, sounded like exactly the same character I'd found in one of her Regency novels, but I think she did transpose them back and forth a bit.
Do they stand up to modern readers?
Yes, I think they do. I mean, there is an element of the social side. I mean, you get the kind of white, sort of certain family, middle class, slightly posh, you know, we don't have dealings with the sort of working people kind of thing, but it's not overt. There wasn't as much racism as I noticed, but then, as I would have expected. But then again, maybe it's just because there aren't sort of non-white characters in there. They just weren't part of the scene.
Mm, mm. And the plots?
Yeah, plots, well put together. I think the characters are better than the plots. Straightforward, but they work. The murder's there right at the beginning, in your face, so you've got to deal with it. But it's like, it's the puzzle kind of setup, I think, rather than the psychological one.
Would it be fair to say that they're a bit like Nio Marsh without the theatrical settings,
yes,
to some extent?
Yes, yeah. More like dysfunctional families,
yeah,
I think,
yeah.
Theatrics.
Yeah. Barry, tell us a bit about Alan Williams.
Well, I think with Alan Williams, I think I'm on a sticky wicket here, because nobody in this audience is going to go out and buy an Alan Williams book. That's why I didn't necessarily go to bat for him. I wanted to go to bat for Eric Ambler, who you will go at, or Peter O'Donnell. who I used to have a meal with once a year. I wonder how long that will go. I'd like to see him be successful again, but he is doing. I think you mentioned, Sarah, that you'd noticed that Peter O'Donnell was Madeline Brent.
Yes, I did.
And made a lot of money writing Georgia Tyre type novels. And Quentin Tarantino wants to make a film, Modesty Blaze, because a very bad movie was made by Joseph Losey with Monica Vitti. She's a wonderful character. She's the one I'd like to fight for. And I know there are women in this room who would fight for Modesty Blaze. She's a survivor. And when you read most crime novels, even well-written ones, there is often an element of with one bound, he or she was free.
Yes.
But Modesty Blaze and Willie Garvin, everything is laid out for the reader in totally structural, sound fashion. They will survive, and here's the reasons they'll survive. You're told throughout the book. And as you said, Declan, they did start as a comic strip. The first Modesty Blaze novel was commissioned because of the movie, and then a whole series followed. Mm-hmm. So I'd go to bat for him more than Alan Williams. I don't think I'm going to persuade anyone to read him. But he's the best writer of maybe the group that I talked about, apart from Amblin.
Right, fine. Thank you, Barry. Sarah, tell us a bit about Christiana Brown.
I found her books quite a lot of years ago. And it's the familiar country house murder. But in most of them, she shows the reader how each leading character could have committed the crime. You give them motive, opportunity, everything. And then she gives it a shake and moves on to the next and shows you how this character could have done it. Her detective is called Inspector Cockerill, and she describes him as a little brown sparrow of a man who smokes incessantly, has nicotine-stained fingers and a disreputable taste in hats. In Green for Danger, which actually is the only one of her books that was filmed, and some of you may have seen it, Alistair Sim played the detective. And the character is beautifully summed up, where he says something like, my presence lay over the hospital like a pall. I found it most enjoyable. Which, you know, really does kind of convey the character. And what's also intriguing to me is that she had the ability to use multiple points of view. Now, normally, as you'll know, when you write, you've got to limit the points of view you use quite a bit. But Brand doesn't. She sort of darts briefly inside the heads of walk-on characters. In a book called Heads You Lose, there's a parlourmaid who has a secret passion for the master of the house, and she fantasises about him. And in terms of the penny romance books of the era, she says something like, the girl's sweet smile and kindly action quite won the heart of the proud old man. And then in Suddenly at His Residence, you get a shutter flash of a toddler who's helping to mow the lawn. And it's something like, the baby was exceedingly busy that afternoon helping to mow the lawn. So you get this lovely inside the mind of this little chubby toddler who's doing this big, important grown-up task, and then she moves on. And I find that admirable. I can't do that. I wish I could, but you know, she has this ability to do that.
Isn't Heads You Lose the one where the character says, I wouldn't be seen dead in the ditch wearing that hat?
But
she is.
Yes. Yeah. In fact, it's in that one where the characters, a lot nicknames. She's very good on names. There's somebody who comes up to sharpen the knives, back to the you know, the big house and the servants, who's called Mr. Matchstick. And the vicar has a mistress called Flossie Port. You think, oh God, I wish I had thought of that one. But it almost reminds me of some of the nicknames that the characters bestow. Again, going back to Nio Marsh, where in Surfeit of Lampreys, the lovely Dotty family, the Lampreys, give nicknames, and they have the bailiff in, and he's called Mr. Grimball, and of course they call him Mr. Grumble, and everybody thinks that's his.
Don't you think that's the problem, Sarah, though? You've just put your finger on the problem. Why these people aren't read today. Simon Brett's new book has characters with those names, but it's all in inverted commas.
Really?
Well, you can only treat it ironically now.
Yes. But then they could do it, and it was acceptable. It's this class divide thing that we keep coming up against.
It's also a certain element of whimsy that we...
Yeah, which isn't fashionable.
Really can't
we don't
stomach
understand.
Anymore.
Yeah, a little bit twee.
Yeah.
Perhaps. But they're still good books, you know.
And
you
very clever.
Would enjoy them.
Very, very ingenious. Yes. She is one of the most ingenious detective novelists of all time, I would guess. Declan. Ross MacDonald.
Not every crime writer gets an obituary in Peanuts, but when Ross MacDonald died, Snoopy was writing a crime novel with a Remington and a fedora on, and Linus comes along and he says, "You've got to put in the tradition of Hammett Chandler and Ross MacDonald on the back. Books sell if you do that." would that that were always true. But MacDonald is... I would say one of the 10 great crime writers in the history of the genre. He did something after Chandler. He rescued PI fiction from the world of fantasy and wish fulfillment. He planted it in an upper middle class milieu. He made it tragic because he gave it a sense of the past and a sense of consequences from generations back and forward. It's interesting when you look at also him in combination with his wife. Margaret Miller had the more successful career early on. They had a daughter who had various health and mental problems. Her career begins to dwindle. His kicks off big time. About 1969, The Goodbye Look got a front page New York Times book review by William Goldman. And MacDonald was a bestseller for the next 20 years, and all the books came back into print. As Miller diminished. So from the point of view of the politics of a couple and their ability to work, it's very interesting. It seems to me that PI fiction turned the wrong corner with Robert Parker. Okay, I'm going to say this. And that Parker's books, while very entertaining, are pastiche at very best, and they're Chandler pastiche, and they've become less and less successful. There's about 10 years that you can read them. To me, they don't hold up anymore. MacDonald, who's almost forgotten now, writes like a grown-up. These are grown-up books. The theme of the missing daughter is always there. They come from a source deep inside him. They are immaculately written. They're patterned, intricately patterned. Many of the later ones have a kind of physical event, an oil spill or a fire, which works as a kind of set of images that blend with the crime story. They are borrowing a little from the Gothic, but they are working. I was on at the PI fiction panel in BoucherCon last year with five other PI writers, and after about half an hour, it turned into basically us telling the audience, "Read Ross MacDonald. Just forget about us. Read Ross MacDonald." I know George Clooney is trying to get a film of The Chill, which is his out and out masterpiece, made from actually a William Goldman script that was originally written for Paul Newman when Paul Newman did the two Harper. They filmed the Archer books as Harper. Movies, The Moving Target, and I think one was called Harper.
The Drowning Pool.
The Drowning Pool, rather, sorry.
Harper was The Moving Target.
Yeah, okay. So I hope if Clooney can get that made. Somebody actually asked me about it recently and said, did I think it should be in period or it should be contemporary? And I said, well, Clooney can wear the suits. It's got to be the 60s or the 50s. You know, he will look great in those clothes. If they get the movie made, maybe we'll have the full-scale revival. But he's like the hidden secret. Linwood Barclay, the best-selling crime writer in the UK last year, was a student of Ross MacDonald's. He met him, and I shook Linwood's hand. So I'm available for the Prince of Wales handshaking duties afterwards.
He's been particularly good as on The Family.
Yeah.
What you might say is the Philip Larkin syndrome, the way you're screwed up by your family.
Absolutely.
Good as any literary novelist.
Yeah, yeah. And that is what imbues them with a grown-up sense. There isn't too often in the PI novel, it's... there's no ties, there's no connections, he's fancy-free, even if it's doomy and gloomy. The hero goes his own way. MacDonald locks the PI into a family and a sense of history and a sense of consequences, and it's cumulative. It's scouring his own soul, and you can feel it as the books go on. He interprets those people for us. First rate.
Can I put one caveat in? I think something you should always not bear in mind when you're reading Ross Macdonald: fathers. It's like women are always duplicitous in Chandler.
Yeah.
Fathers are always corrupt, absent. There's something wrong with the father in Macdonald. I don't know what it says about him.
Yeah. There's a fair few scary women in there as well.
Yeah. But
because eventually you've got to ring the changes on the old plot, or people will see it coming.
That's the thing. Well, we do think that we're keen for you to read and remember Ross Macdonald and all the writers we've been talking about, but please don't forget us as well. Right, question time, and remember there is this bag of books as well. Hey,
you mentioned various authors that you'd like to see back in your book. Could you each choose one author and a book from that author and say, you can really bring back up some of things?
Mary?
I think Ethelina White, and I will say Wax, because although I did manage to get a copy, it was a very old copy, and it was very atmospheric, and to the point where I remember getting off the train at 11 o'clock, having to walk through a car park with this in my head, and I thought, very creepy. Yeah, read it.
Barry?
I'm going to cheat and choose two. No, I'm sorry. Francis Clifford, Act of Mercy, which is a wonderful book about a man on the run in a dangerous country. The danger comes from outside, from the police who are pursuing him, from his wife, who wonders why he's thrown their life away and the life of the child that's yet to be born. And Alan Williams, Barbu's wonderful book.
Thank you. Sarah?
I think Christiana Brand's Heads You Lose. It's so well written, such good characters, and it's a long time before you actually see what the denouement is. And then all of it, then it's revealed, and you think, oh, yes, of course. It's very clever, very entertaining. So I would recommend that.
Thanks. Declan?
I'm going to go with Margaret Miller, and I mean, in particular, A Stranger in My Grave. This woman is dreaming that she can see her own headstone, and she has this dream several times. And then she does see her own headstone. And get out of that one. Yeah. So, I would speak up for any of the others. Hell Like an Angel, in particular.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. Stranger in My Grave is absolutely fantastic. I very much second that. And I think my choice as well would be the book I mentioned before, Anthony Barclay, Trial and Error. Cynical, but very, very witty and very, very clever as well. Bill,
what do you think about Michael Ennis, Edmund Crispin? We tried those books for our reading group the past year. And the younger people were not at all interested. They were completely turned off. They had no idea why we found any humor in them, why we enjoyed the books as writing at all. And we sort of sat there and couldn't explain our feeling. But they just blew it off completely and said, this is of no interest to us today.
This is a question we were talking about beforehand, the idea that are there concrete reasons for some of these writers being forgotten?
Yeah.
And will they, are they all capable of being remembered again, or are some just... is their time gone? You know.
And also, humour is very subjective,
right,
isn't it? And I'm assuming this was in America.
That's correct. Yeah.
Humour doesn't always travel, does it? People.
But
don't
I'm from America,
want
and I love.
I know,
but I can sit there and smile and laugh, and some of the humour that is presently enjoyed in the States, it just turns me off. I have no understanding with it.
That's because you're unusual. You're unique.
I know that. Yeah.
And anyone speaking up for Edmund Crispin?
Interesting. Again, there are crime writers, including Laura Wilson, who's not here, who thinks he's vastly overrated. This is a woman, Edmund Crispin,
really?
And says, I can't understand his reputation at all. And I say, well, there you go. Horses for courses.
Yeah, I think Michael Innes, who's a similar writer to Edmund Crispin, is someone I'd put in that bracket. I've never quite seen Michael Innes his genius, but Edmund Crispin I did enjoy, and Moving Toy Shop is a very clever book.
That's the one that no one really enjoyed whatsoever.
There's a problem with archness, though. There's a kind of insufferably arch, winking humour in every line with Crispin that makes you feel should I take these seriously at all? Because you're evidently not.
There is that, and of course he speaks to the reader, doesn't he,
on
one or two occasions.
What,
he directly addresses, if this wasn't a detective story, then blah, 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 blah.
But
isn't it
to do also with the quality of humorous writing? Raymond Chandler's I Was Everything the Well-Dressed Private Eye Should Be, utterly timeless. Mm. You can read those books. I mean, there's problems like the racism that you find in Chandler, for instance, but the humour still works.
Yeah.
Crispin also published his first book when he was an undergraduate, and he was burnt out by the time he was in his early 30s, so a very curious career.
He was a composer.
He composed the music for the Carry On films. So there is life.
Tough.
There is life after crime writing.
And he was a very big drinker, even for a crime writer.
He was. Maxine.
Parker, or McDonald. Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, there's no question that in the past 10, 15 years, I mean, writers have picked up the baton. And I was lucky enough to meet Peter Temple in Australia last year, and we had an hour-long conversation about Ross MacDonald and how fantastic he was, and what an inspiration. And, I mean, he is to me. You can see his influence much more now, but he is still the invisible man, so to speak. Everybody thinks PI, and they go straight back to Chandler and skip. And I think for also younger authors or aspiring authors, Chandler's probably not a great model,
So is Ed Lloyd the illegitimate offspring of Lou Archer?
I would have to say, I'm trying not to let it show quite as much as I go on, but there's an epigraph from MacDonald in each of the first two books, so I couldn't possibly hide it.
We'll try and fit in two more questions before time is up.
Some of us, anyway, remember reading them in the past. When you were talking about humour, I was thinking about Colin Watts, very much enjoyed.
Flaxborough.
Especially Broomsticks Over Flaxborough. And then I thought that it was very much set in the period where witches were in.
That's the writer.
Maybe to a modern reader, they wouldn't be enjoyed.
Yeah, that's a really good point, which none of us have talked about. It is the nostalgia element. And that's probably why you have difficulty communicating with your students. They haven't got the nostalgia.
Yes.
Yes. So what are you talking about? Unless you can point to hard core, but for all of us, it's nostalgia. We were looking at these books, and we were just enjoying those objects.
Yes.
It's nostalgia.
I mean, it's the ads on the back. I was trying to work out how much these were worth.
So maybe we're not the best advocates of these books.
I'm not convinced that actually. I think MacDonald and Miller are evade that perhaps because they don't go back to the 30s or the 40s.
You and I read Ross MacDonald at a certain age.
Well, that's true.
And we read the Fontana with the beautiful, colourful covers, possibly.
Yes, yes.
So they are part of when we started reading detective fiction.
Completely, but I do think they stand up in a way that you don't have to make as many allowances as you do. I mean, as you say with Chandler, the misogyny. That there are many more allowances you have to make with Chandler. Much and all as I love him now, with MacDonald, you don't have to do that.
One more question.
Or maybe I'm just blind.
One more question, Peter.
Nostalgia actually leads nicely to my question. I have about 20 questions. I'll just ask one of them. This idea of forgotten books. If any of you read crime fiction blogs, you know that the last year or so that's exploded. Everybody is, Patty Abbott is doing her Friday Forgotten Books. A lot of people are doing. Why this sudden interest in forgotten books? What is there about the zeitgeist against people? And I don't think.
My take on it, Peter, is that nostalgia, no doubt, is part of it. I'm almost nostalgic for the Elliot Gould remake of Lady Vanishes.
That's carrying nostalgia too far.
Tongue in cheek. But I think it's also that understanding something about what led to the books that we write, the history, I think for present day crime writers, understanding the traditions is actually quite useful as well as very enjoyable. Sarah?
I think there's perhaps also the point that era that we've been focusing on is now just far enough back to be a little bit, I'm trying not to use the word romantic, but it's the only word I can think of. You know, it's, yes, what's the line? The past is a different country. They do things differently there, or whatever the line is. And I wonder if it's now shrouded in a certain charm, because we can still just about touch it. You know, our parents can remember it. Some of us, our grandparents.
But we have the advantage of being able to sift through, you know, the many thousands of books that were written over the years and pick out the good stuff and remember that. And it's undoubtedly the case now that there are people writing that we perhaps don't know as well as other people, who are coming up with brilliant stuff, and hopefully not in 50 years' time.
I'm just going to say that.
Our successors will be going, and they were terribly forgotten back then.
Okay, here's the plan.
That's a rather depressing way to end this.
What we do, we hijack the TARDIS, we go forward 50 years, and we say, if you're all sitting here talking about us then,
we don't want to be forgotten, do we?
Oh, no.
That's just another answer to your question, and that's the publisher initiative. Every publisher is looking through the back catalogue now. Faber reissuing Cyril Hare, for instance, you know about.
Yeah, Cyril Hare.
Mm-hmm. So everybody is now checking their backlist to see who will still work for a modern audience. So I think publishers are a factor.
They call it Watson's social history.
Yeah.
Penguin.
That's right. Right, time, the clock meister has beaten us. Thanks very much for your attendance. I'd like, of course, to thank my wonderful panellists, Barry, Mary, Sarah, Declan. Thank you for turning up on this Friday afternoon. We've enjoyed the panel. We hope you found it interesting and enjoyable as well. It remains to award the prize for the best question. I was given the task of making myself unpopular, but as a lawyer I'm used to that, so it's only fair, and I think the person who sparked the discussion on nostalgia should take the books. Thank you very much indeed, and we'll see you, we hope, in the signing room. Thank you.
John D. MacDonald, yeah. I know.
All those colours?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.